Hello and welcome to episode 116 of the Nerds Assemble podcast.
This week we'll be looking at Amiibos, Deadpool, Doctor Strange, digital goods, Terminator Genesis, and our feature this week, a tribute to Ralph Baer. Nerds.
Hi, I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
We might have Cookie at some point. There's a chance of him dropping in, you know, parachute and all. Hopefully he'll remember to, you know, roll when he lands rather than shattering his shins and ankles.
But, that'd be bad.
Yeah, but hopefully, you know, we might get him a bit later. If not, you've still got us. But as ever, you can find the show notes for this episode over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. You can also comment there. You can also find links to our social accounts. Plus, if you do want to get directly in touch with us and ask questions or just, you know, comment directly to us about the show, send us an email at contact@nerdassemble.co.uk. You could try tweeting us at Nerds Podcast. I'd like to remind people that, you know, if you've got time and, you know, you like listening to this very free podcast. We appreciate reviews on iTunes you're using iTunes.
Do they do non-free podcast? Can we sell our podcast?
We could, but for reasons you will learn later, this may not be the best thing. But first, I want to talk about a Fox Amiibo that had to be taken out by a Smash Brothers champion the other week. I saw this reported on Silicon Era. Currently, the level cap on the Amiibos, you know, the little figurines that you can use with the Nintendo Wii U, is level 50. This, you know, Star Fox figurine was at level 50 with the nickname of Waveshine. It got entered into, you know, just kind of like a fun tournament that had been set up, I think, basically to kind of like celebrate various things. And there was a series of fighting games that were at the tournament, including the new Super Smash Brothers. And, well, you know, it kind of kept... It wasn't going to be in the tournament originally, and then someone decided to enter it for fun. And you had to pay money to enter the tournament, and so a bunch of people put $5 each forward to pay for its entry fee. And nobody thought it was going to get very far. In fact, it actually did get very far. According to Silicon Era, in fact, much to everyone's laughter and disbelief, Waveshine won its way up to the losers' semi-finals, where it was only knocked out by Firefly, one of the region's best Super Smash Bros. Brawl players. They've got video at the link, which you'll see in the show notes, where you can watch all this. It was Firefly who ended up going on to win the tournament. So considering that, it seems Waveshine ended up outdoing most of the human players at the tournament. This, remember, is an Amiibo, a little piece of learning software that's linked to a plastic figurine.
So is it with Shine Skynet?
Do you know, I think perhaps this is ultimately how Skynet will come about, and obviously again...
through Smash Bros. Tournament.
Through Smash Bros. You see, the new Genesis film, the trailer, it's got it all wrong. It's got it absolutely all wrong. It'll be Amiibos and their AI.
But fortunately, there won't be that many of them because Nintendo like making sure there's a lot of demand.
And or people won't be able to buy so many because in other Amiibo-related news, Game UK decided to raise the prices of their Amiibos from $11.99 to $14.99.
And is it Target or whatever in the US apparently did it as well?
The thing is, though, is that Reggie has, I think it... No, it may not have been Reggie, it may have just been representative from Nintendo of America, did turn around and say that because the Amiibos were going to be kind of, what's the word?
Limited
edition. So basically once the first wave come out, then you couldn't buy them anymore. But I think they have changed their minds on that, so you will be able to buy at least the figurines that are out now. And continue to buy them.
I can just imagine that they'll probably, after about a year or so, they may re-release characters. It's just they'll be in different poses or outfits. Because, you know...
And then it'll be the editions. Oh, no, yeah. I've got a first edition Samus.
Because there's only so many Nintendo characters you could make a convincing Amiibo out of. you know, something that's going to kick butt, and pretty much anything that's going to kick butt or, you know, has some degree of agency in a game is already in Smash Brothers or Mario Kart.
Can I just sneak in the in a very underhanded comment that it was probably just a, you know, that Wave Shine amiibo was probably just a random button mash generator.
Well,
and that's why it nearly won.
It does learn from players. So if you can either learn from CPUs or players. So if you've been playing it a lot and you were a button basher, then it would have played like a button basher. I heard from a friend at work today that one of their amiibos, because they like to play by just running around the field and keeping out of the way for as long as possible, that their amiibo that they trained was doing that does that now
right.
when in a fight. Meanwhile, their friend's one that just goes for all on out attacks and keeps trying to combo and stuff, you know, that just chased him everywhere around.
Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the amiibos do learn, and you can power them up by feeding them, you know, kind of the stats and whatnot. And you can, admittedly, kind of adjust their appearance and their moveset as well.
Mm.
So it's, you are definitely making something that is far more unique than the bog standard, you know, plain Mario or plain Luigi or plain Link or whatever, which is kind of cool in a way.
I'm still not convinced.
Which is fair enough. I mean, but to be honest, I think one of the things that gaming has never really got right is personalities in video games. You know, that there are some games that have had kind of personalities, and you know, they've kind of got a sense of being right. So, say for example, Perfect Dark, which we were playing at the weekend, that has stuff like the Judge Sim, which will, you know, kind of deliberately go after the person who's kind of winning and leave off on the you know, the players that are losing. There's the Venge Sim,
which is the blue shell bot.
Yeah. There's the Venge Sim that will basically, if he's on your team and you accidentally shoot him, he will deliberately target you. So he will team kill you, which I find absolutely brilliant. There's also, you know, several different kind of pacifist type ones that you kind of go around collecting guns or disarming people and don't actually kind of go for the kills or anything.
Virtua Fighter 2 on the Sega Saturn, I think, was supposed to learn from the player.
I think
because its save game got progressively massive.
I think one of the Tekken's, definitely like Tekken 3, I swear it used to learn from you. And even if you had like the difficulty kind of set quite low, even though it would remain on that, it would get slowly and slowly more difficult to defeat computer players.
I've got a mixed experience when it comes to AI programming and stuff like that. There was an old 16-bit game called Gods by the Bitbat Brothers, and that was on the Atari ST, Amiga, and I think the Mega Drive got a version as well. But the problem I had with that was it was reviewed as, oh, it's awesome, it learns from how you play, and it gets harder if you're good. Which meant that everyone I knew who was shit at games at school completed it, and it kicked my ass. And it kicked several other, you know, friends' asses who, you know, really, you know, had to go at it. And it's just.
But I mean, that isn't necessarily to do with personality. That's basically just kept more kind of analysing and countermeasures.
I know. I'm referring more to the sort of Perfect Dark bots.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, it's, you know, just AI nature rather than, you know, personality in them.
The whole thing with the amiibos, especially when in relation to how they're used for Smash Brothers at the moment, reminds me a lot of various Japanese anime and manga over the years with types of like battle bot and stuff. So like, I don't know, like from like Metabots to Angelic Layer, just kind of like these little, almost like, I mean, obviously they're not robots, but little things that you sort of train up to then do fighting against other people.
Hmm.
I mean, I already know someone who has all of the amiibos.
And it isn't me.
No, it's not you.
No, I don't have all of them. I just have six.
Oh, is that all?
Well,
and how much was that again?
He's not allowed to say.
I'm not allowed to say.
You're not allowed to say.
Fair enough.
But RRP, that would be...
Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous.
I'm not judging you out loud.
It's a good thing somebody gets discounts.
But by the same token, it's an aspect to the game which is actually quite good. Well, I found anyway, you know, the fact that, you know, you can actually pretty much kind of build up a personality and whatnot. And I remember seeing like a meme image of basically this girl kind of sitting down to play, you know, kind of multiplayer with all her amiibos and whatnot. And it is kind of like you're making your friends in a kind of weird, solitary, kind of sad way.
I'm not going to say anything about Nintendo fans in that way. And I'm just not. I'm too polite to.
Obviously, going back to the Fox amiibo that drew up this conversation in my mind, not literally, but
it's learning.
It sort of makes me think that I wouldn't want to see amiibos too much on the tournament scene for esports and fighting games, but at the same time it's unlikely that they will. But I could just see, like, the you'd still have your main kind of, I know, like Smash Brothers tournaments, and they're just kind of, you know, it's human versus human. But I can imagine there being like maybe a new character, it's not category now, where you bring amiibos.
Yeah, I would like to see that kind of thing happen, where basically you're not entering the tournament yourself, you're entering an amiibo to fight on your behalf type thing. It's almost Pokemon-ish.
But
I was just about to say, hands up who thinks it's only a matter of time for Nintendo to bring out individual Pokemon amiibos.
I don't think they'll do that.
You don't?
I don't think they will bring out like individual.
If they none were, that are,
not in Smash Bros. Anyway.
If they were to bring out a fully 3D imagined game on the Wii U as opposed to 3DS, they might bring out some. Like, I could imagine them doing like maybe the starter Pokemon.
On the new 3DS, which is the most terrible name for a console ever, which has near field communications built in,
yeah,
as well.
I think what they could do is, instead of having actual amiibos, they could have like little discs or something like that with like just the images of the Pokemon on, so that they can sell it for like £2 or something like that. That I could see, but not, you know, full blown amiibos.
Also, one final thing, if you were going to have amiibos in tournaments, you would have to make sure that they weren't easily hackable, because that's one of the things that they always have to worry about when it comes to things like, just say, Pokemon tournaments, where you're creating pre-generated characters essentially to fight in the tournament, is to make sure that they haven't been hacked and illegally generated. Like, they have to have been legitimately created. But I'm going to move on to our next story. I've just amalgamated two stories here because it's Marvel
casting,
but it's not all Marvel. One side's Fox, one side's Marvel Disney. How do I say this? Is it Ryan Reynolds? It is Ryan Reynolds.
Yes, it is Ryan Reynolds.
Ryan Reynolds, yeah. Is set to return as Deadpool in a Fox-led movie. It is unclear at this point whether or not it fits in with the continuity of the existing Fox-owned, well, sort of Marvel film franchises. In theory, Origins Wolverine didn't happen at the moment. In theory, if you watch this year's film, you'll perhaps get a sense of... happen and it could not have happened.
The X-Men.
Yeah, it right. All depends.
Fair enough. That makes sense with it being a timey-wimey.
Yeah. He confirmed the choice of him as casting by having this lovely picture posted on Twitter, which was essentially Deadpool's face composed of various types of gun ammo, you know, a wide variety of bullets, ranging from shotgun shells to, I think I saw some 9mm, I might have been mistaken, all arranged in his mask.
How very American.
Yes. You certainly couldn't have easily done that over here.
The old colonists.
Yeah. According to Empire, Zombieland writers Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick have written the script.
Now, presumably this is the film Zombieland rather than the ill-fated Amazon series.
I would have thought that they would have quoted a TV series if they meant TV series.
Okay. Since they're talking about movies.
Meanwhile, over on the sort of Marvel side of things, Benedict Cumberbatch has been confirmed to play Doctor Strange in the 2016 movie that'll be coming out.
I wonder if he'll play him as slightly haughty and eccentric.
It could potentially suit the character.
Just a slight comment on Cumberbatch's
characters. Yeah. That's played us.
Character.
The thing is, almost every time I've seen Doctor Strange in any of the comics, he's always been drawn as a bit buff. Okay. So he's not...
Yeah, but how much of that is just because it's a superhero? So in other words, everyone has to, you know, spend
then,
10 hours in a gym a day.
Yeah, but then what's his face? Mr. Fantastic. He's never been buff, as far as I can tell. He's always been a bit on the skinnier side.
Spider-Man's been mostly... Well, sometimes skinnier.
90s Spider-Man. Yeah. Isn't.
Nightcrawler, obviously skinnier.
Trying to think of skinny male superheroes. This is difficult. But anyway, going back to Doctor Strange, currently Scott Derrickson is directing the film. And it is obviously part of Marvel's Phase 3 superhero movie shenanigans. I can't pronounce his name. John Spates is writing the script. There'll be links to this that will make, you know, then you can make up for yourselves, you know, how the hell you pronounce his surname.
Bob.
You know.
Bob. John Bob.
Yes.
I have to say, out of the two, I think I'm looking forward more to a Doctor Strange movie than a Deadpool movie, purely because once upon a time I thought Deadpool was kind of cool, and then I realised that he's basically some weird 90s male power fantasy, yet vulnerable at the same time, but still some weird kind of power fantasy, and it's very confusing.
I get that
he breaks the fourth wall all the time, but...
To be honest, I don't think you're meant to be like quite know his character. You're not meant to be able to predict what he's gonna do.
It's kind of the point of the character, from what I've seen of him.
Yeah. So I don't think he's gonna be, you know, overly misogynistic or, you know, anything like that. But he's definitely a jokester, or, you know, jester, joker type character.
Probably not allowed to call him a joker, just in case, you know.
Next bit of news related, this is actually comics and games news, but certainly for the indie scene, in the last few weeks there's been a sudden eruption over new VAT laws that are coming in January. They were agreed upon by the EU, including us, in 2008. And currently, HMRC and the Department for sort of Business Skills and Innovation, blah, blah, have said that people have had fair warning that these things were coming and that they've advertised for that, blah, blah, this. And it turns out pretty much every sole trader to small business that's affected by this new VAT legislation didn't know a thing about it until suddenly it started popping up in a couple of news articles in the last couple of weeks. So they'd done a very good job, our government, of publicising this thing that could affect people who sell digital goods.
So what do you mean you weren't paying attention to something that we only last mentioned about 6 years ago?
Or put on the back arse end of some ridiculously constructed government website, which is a fair amount of government websites.
Yeah.
So, currently it's like sort of like a, there's attempts to try and get the stuff stalled, at least here, because nobody's ready. A whole thing going from the sort of like from government side saying, oh, it won't affect sole traders that much. There's not that many people that'll be affected by this. And it appears that they've underestimated the number of businesses, which includes sole traders to sort of small business. So micros there as well. They've underestimated the figures of the number of businesses affected by probably 40%. Mm. They think the number of businesses affected is like probably under 100,000. Whereas that's in fact,
it's a lot of businesses really, anyway.
Probably double that. So yeah, there's like, I'm a member of like a like some Facebook group that's to do with comics, and it's comics creators and that, and I kind of like put a link to it the other week. I was like, do you guys know about this? Because I don't have any digital comics on sale at the moment. And they're like, what? And everyone who's currently selling through their own website and taking payments pretty much obviously directly, you know, through a limited kind of payment system, like that no one's getting a cut other than them, would have to suddenly start registering for that for any sales that might happen in different European countries. Despite the fact that over here they are most probably earning below the VAT threshold, which is £81,000 at the moment. Seriously, like I can't name any British comics creators that are on over £81,000 a year. I can't name many people that aren't in government or, you know,
yeah,
big companies and stuff that aren't, yeah. So basically it's a very limited number anyway who'd be paying VAT in this country, but VAT laws are different in other European countries. And so if you happen to have a website and, I don't know, somebody in somewhere in Europe, someone in Italy buys your comic, you would now from January have to collect two bits of information about this person. And this is if you're, you know, if the payment's coming pretty much directly to you. Obviously charge VAT for that product then at the Italian rate of VAT for that product. Keep a record of this transaction and that person's personal details for up to 10 years. And obviously, you know, you've then lost money for VAT that, at least in this country, if you were selling that to a UK person, you wouldn't be paying anyway because you're, you know, you would be under the VAT threshold.
Yeah.
So it's, and if you're registered for VAT, you have to do quarterly reports to various tax offices that of what VAT you've paid.
Oh, bloody hell.
So it's suddenly adding this whole load of administrative crap on one person band. You know, like, you know, you're just a creator trying to sell some stuff, and there's a lot of people in that position at the moment. Mm. And not just comics, you know, a lot of games developers admittedly will sell through various marketplaces, and in theory some of those people wouldn't be affected. I mean, if you sell through Comixology as a creator, you're potentially not affected by this new VAT law, because there's this whole thing about if another company is like, not the bank, but like another company is dealing with the payments and that, they're responsible for sorting out the VAT. But it's not entirely clear how you prove who is really in charge of the payment ultimately, if it's going through a third party like Comixology or Google Play or Steam, if you say you're an indie games creator. Like Blastoff, Zeotex on Twitter, Percy, he was sort of like tweeting about it today, and he was just like, oh my god, he'd suddenly been reading this thing and did this screen caption about this whole third party payment situation, and he's like, wait, so if I sell through this, you know, third party, am I still though responsible for that, because it has, you know,
yeah, not exactly clear.
Everything's a bit messed up. Nobody who is a major player it seems at the moment, in terms of taking, you know, they are a third party and they deal with payments. No, none of them, like, so Amazon and all that, haven't, and Google, haven't clarified whether or not you're going to be responsible for sorting out, you know, recording personal details to do VAT payments over all transactions. And the thing is, though, is that as soon as you collect so much information about individuals as a company, that means that, at least in this country, you then have to register with the Information Commissioner's office because you're holding personal information, and it's, you know, Data Protection Act and everything. So there's another level of admin added.
I mean, the whole other level of things, like, what happens if someone buys something, you know, with their Steam wallet or credit they've got on PlayStation Network or Xbox Live? Do, you know, is the VAT paid on buying the credit in the first place, or...
No idea. Exactly? No idea. Yeah. But the thing is that it doesn't just affect people, say, from the UK selling to the rest of Europe. It affects people from the rest of Europe selling to the UK. And that it also affects anyone from outside of Europe selling to Europe. Because it's basically all the countries suddenly being like, oh, we want the VAT. And it's like, I get that VAT has to be... What I say has to be... Actually, I actually disagree with the concept of value-added tax on goods transactions. Because of the fact that we've got so many different things being bought now that it's just adding a layer of tax onto people's lives and businesses. That it's just kind of like, why can't you just collect it all on, you know, earnings?
Yeah.
Rather than individual transactions. It's just, it's like there's so many transactions happening now. I hate to think how many financial transactions that aren't large payments happen between individuals and businesses every second at the moment. And that's a huge amount of data that's been generated there. And they're trying to, you know, they're trying to rip out a bit of money here and there from it. And in theory, this new VAT laws, they weren't meant to be fucking up, obviously, sole traders and small businesses. It was meant to be going after the big boys. You know who I mean?
Yeah.
Amazon and Google. And it's like, yeah, but nobody's actually looked at how it would affect small business. Vince Cable today replied to a petition to get the whole thing stalled. And he didn't appear to have been briefed on the results of meetings that happened last week between the petition creator, Enterprise Nation, who, if you're ever thinking of starting up your own business, Enterprise Nation is actually a very good place to look for advice. But, you know, they obviously, they're very much about the concerns of small business and sole traders. And so they had a meeting with an MP and a couple of other, I think, HMRC representatives. And Vince Cable, who replied to this position today, hadn't been briefed on the results of that meeting, which appears that the meeting had been a quite positive one. And the concerns that people obviously have, and which I've tried to explain to you guys.
Yeah.
Were discussed in that, and it seems that Cable hadn't been briefed at all, and his reply just came up as completely idiotic, and, like, he just didn't care. And so the people who created the petition replied to him, pointing this out and saying, you know, look, go read this stuff, get briefed on what we talked about last week with your, you know, this MP.
I mean, and he's only the business secretary.
Yeah. So somebody's dropped the ball somewhere. I've had to be a bit honest, the whole thing, somebody's dropped the ball, because nobody's thought about how businesses are doing business if it's just one individual trading over the internet.
Which is a lot of people these days.
Yeah, because the recession happened and suddenly being self-employed, essentially, seemed like a better deal than having 0 hours contracts and such like. But I'm going to stop trying to bore you now with new VAT laws, but basically, I looked into it enough and I felt compelled enough to write to my MP about it and go, can you talk to somebody about this? This is crazy. Obviously, I could write to an MEP, but unfortunately, UKIP kind of won most of the seats in my area during the European elections this year.
Oh, Jesus.
So I don't think there's much point in writing to my nearest MEP at the moment. But on to something that may be more positive or negative or neutral, because I'm not sure I'm still quite where I stand on this. The first trailer for Terminator Genesis dropped last week.
And how is that spelled?
I would like to guess at the moment from the notes, G-E-N-I-S-Y-S.
Yes, Genesis. Genesis. See what they did, because it's clever.
What was kind of funny was how the trailer dropped not probably about 3 hours after the James Bond Spectre announcement. And what happened with my Twitter and Facebook was, oh yeah, there was James Bond. And then, oh God, Terminator trailer. Just completely wiped away all mention of Bond in any of my social media.
Well, Bond didn't really do much, did it?
No, it left me wondering if DC would ever go after them.
Oh, there's a few things that use the word Spectre.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Spectre's been around in DC Comics since either the 50s or the 60s, maybe earlier. So, yeah. But did you watch the trailer, Paul?
I did.
Did you watch the trailer, Paul? I'm looking at him. Yeah.
You're looking at me?
Yeah, I'm looking at you.
I did watch the trailer. You were with me at the time, so you should know. So yeah, Arnie is old. What?
Apparently he's been waiting a while.
Yep, and things seem to have kind of come back to, it seems like, the time of Terminator 2. That could just be the influence of the
and the original Terminator.
Because it looked like you had the, was it T-1000, which was the metallic-y...
Or AT-1000.
Yeah, AT-1000.
Patrick.
And, yeah, it's kind of confusing what the hell is going on, because it's like... Kyle Reese has gone back in time to prevent the Terminator from doing stuff, and there's another
and he's somehow time traveled into an already existing alternative timeline to his location.
It kind of makes sense, because after all, it's all about altering the past and doing all these things. So it, you know, in that respect, it makes. I kind of liked the way that, because I am a fan of the original.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It was shot for shot with Cal Reese appearing in the alleyway. On the cop car at the alleyway, you know, shining a light down, and him going into the department store and stealing the clothes. That was pretty much, you know, shot for shot for the original film.
Mm.
And then, of course, he gets rescued by Sarah Connor.
Yeah, militarized.
That's not supposed to happen.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting take. I'm not sure how they're going to explain it. It's probably going to be like, oh, okay.
Well, it's always Go on.
I thought there was a hint in the trailer that the timeline had changed.
Mm.
Somebody said, I'm pretty sure it wasn't comment. It was something that was said.
Yeah.
In the trailer.
Well, there were a few things, like a presumably young Sarah Connor as a little girl being sort of carried away from what looked like a lake by, you know, Arnie's Terminator. So he's been there for a while. Now, from a time travel perspective, it makes perfect sense that if you've got a time machine, it doesn't matter where, you know, when you send them back, it's where you send them back to. You could send several things back at once. Because that was a conceit used in Terminator 2, that the T-1000 was sent back, you know, pretty much immediately right after Arnie's Terminator. It was just sent to a different time as insurance.
Hmm.
So, it all does kind of make sense. And is that what's-her-face from, you know, is that Carlisi from Game of Thrones was playing Sarah Connor now, or is it someone else?
Yes, no, I think it is.
I don't think it...
There was lots of Game of Thrones references after Khaleesi. The trailer came out.
No, sorry. I was thinking Thingy from Sarah Connor Chronicles.
It was Cersei.
Yeah. But that'd be interesting. Two actors from Game of Thrones that played as Sarah Connor. That's kind of interesting.
I mean, I've seen several... Well, I've seen a lot of negative reaction to it, but so far as I'm concerned, if it's better than Terminator 3, which won't be hard, and if it's better than Terminator Salvation, which had one or two decent bits but was largely shit in every other way, including plot, then it's welcome to try, because we've already had two bloody awful sequels. Absolutely. After Terminator 2, so... Yeah, go ahead.
It does make me wonder. It does make me wonder whether it's actually going to do anything about the Sarah Connor Chronicles, because wasn't that left on a cliffhanger where John Connor goes to the future or something?
Yes, it was.
I doubt they'll touch the TV series at all.
Which is a pity, because I quite like the TV series for all its we're on a shit budget, so can't actually show much of the future or the Terminator-y stuff.
Well, to be honest, it pretty much retcons the third film, doesn't it? It comes to something when, you know, you have like series of films like the Terminator or X-Men that kind of retcons or tries to retcon all the bad films in the franchise as though that's going to somehow redeem it. It's like, no, because the fans will get the complete collection matter how shit the bad ones are.
I think it's, you know, of all the franchises I could think of, Terminator is one I'll let them off to changing things like that, because after all, that was a conceit of the first film.
Time travel, yeah.
Yeah, and changing the past and trying to prevent changes to the past and, you know, all of that, so...
It's, I think, for me, it's not like I'm necessarily excited per se, I'm just kind of... I would like to watch it. I'm not going to judge it, before I've watched it. I'm not going to be expecting that much from it, which is probably usually a good sign if my recent experiences say anything to go by. Every time I go to the cinema now and I expect a film to be a bit meh, then it's usually like really, really good. And every time I expect a film to be really, really good, it's usually meh, like, X-Men. I was expecting that to be like really, really good, and it's like, it's not as good as First Class. I'm sorry, it's not.
I'll just be waiting to see that. Just like, well, more or less everything else I watch. But I have thought of a good thing about Terminator 3.
Oh, okay.
Which was the way they ended it. I was going to say the end, but that just sounds like me being an arse. The way that it ended with them not managing to avert Judgment Day, I liked that.
I liked the concept of also of going after John Connor's generals as well. That was an interesting concept.
Yeah, that was all right. But, oh God, there's so much else wrong with that.
I think they really miscast the role of John Connor in that one. He seemed like he wasn't kind of savvy enough, in a way. Because, I mean, you know, you have...
After John Connor in T2.
Exactly. Yeah, he was like 10 years... How old was he in that?
Which, sorry?
In Terminator 2, how old was John Connor? Because he must have been about 10 or like 8 or something.
No,
like
not
that.
8. He's under 14, but...
Yeah, I would say, like 12 or 13, like... You know, just starting sort of teens.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, you know, he was kind of running around on, driving around on motorcycles, having like, you know, this tech to basically take money out of cash points, and, you know, by hacking them and, you know.
Well, it's not just that, but there's the whole point that he makes that before he was taken away from his mum and his mum was institutionalised, he'd been out and about with her training.
Yeah. And, you know, being able to kind of fire and take care of himself and stuff. And
yeah,
you don't kind of get that sense of John Connor in the third one. And yeah, that one felt a bit flat.
Like I said, there's just so much that's wrong with anything after Terminator 2.
I was trying to find out who owns the rights to Sarah Connor Chronicles, because I don't think they're going to get referenced at all in the film.
Isn't it Fox?
Well, they were one of the production companies behind it and had the sort of like screening rights. Mm. But because I'm looking at the Wikipedia, production companies involved were Sarah Connor Pictures, Bartleby Company, C2 Pictures, the Halcon Company, Warner Brothers Television, 20th Century Fox Television. The distributor for the series was Warner Brothers Television Distribution. The original channel was Fox. So yeah, it probably is Fox, whereas the film rights, yeah. It was originally, the Wikipedia claims that despite being, that it was meant to be a prequel to Rise of the Machines and a tie-in to the spin-off film of Salvation, but obviously that clearly didn't really materialise as a thing. So, yeah.
It had some of Glau kicking ass in it. So yeah. That's always a good thing. You know, Summer Glau beats up everyone.
Mm. And, you know, John Connor kind of having a hard on for a Terminator.
So to speak.
I think, like with the discussion of Star Wars.
There's so much I could say about, you know, software, hardware, firmware, wetware.
I was going to say that.
I think you've said enough already.
And as with the discussion of Star Wars last week, I think I'll wait till I see the film before I panic.
Did you hear about the three-pronged Terminator that they've got in it? Oh, God, that doesn't work, etc.
Three-pronged Terminator?
It's a
reference to the stupid lightsaber arguments.
All right. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
With the actually, the lightsabers have apparently been there in some of the Expanded Universe stuff.
If you bring that up, people are like, oh, but that all got retconned anyway. And it's like, but they did assign somebody to shift through all the previous continuity stuff to see if there was anything they could use.
Yeah, anything cool. List of anything cool. There we go. Put it on the list.
To be honest, Star Wars isn't really my sci-fi. Anyway, so I'm probably going to enjoy it in the way that, you know, most people like just enjoy
playing. The thing I want to know is there going to be ice skating Ewoks in the 7th film?
What?
I feel like this. I should know this.
You shouldn't. I just think that Ewoks ice skating on screen would be the coolest thing ever.
I feel like that's been referenced somewhere, but
I'm not sure about that.
Are you just being random?
I think I've been just being random. And that's, of course, a piece of pop culture has lodged itself somewhere in my brain, and I don't know where the hell it's from.
I'm seeing a scene from the Snoopy Christmas special.
It's not like Charlie South Brown. Park or anything.
No.
Like, mentioned it, like, sometime.
I'm sure I can't be the first person to think of ice skating Ewoks.
Yeah, but most people would just sort of, wake up sweating and screaming.
Okay.
I still want a Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic film. Yeah, bastards.
Where is up? Knights of the Old Republic, is that actually meant to be set before the prequel films?
Oh, hell yeah.
By how much?
At least 1,000 years, I think.
Seriously? Oh, blimey.
Yeah, the whole idea behind them is that technology just reached that level where you know, there wasn't much else they could do.
Okay.
So they'd already, you know, developed FTL and, you know, lightsabers, blasters, you know, all of that kind of thing. So.
Okay, so they kind of reached the pinnacle of technology with the science that they had and, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the only thing that would change would be the politics and people in the, you know, that galaxy.
See, I quite like that concept.
Have you played KOTOR, the original KOTOR?
I have not. No.
You should. It's aged a little bit, but it's still recognisably a BioWare game.
Mm.
And it's a damn good RPG in the Star Wars universe, and it's got good characters with personality.
Mm.
So yeah, I still want a Kotal game.
I'm going to move on next to what we've been up to. Retroid, I assume you've been playing more Elite Dangerous. Have there been any interesting developments?
Well, apart from noticing on Raptor that it's got me recorded for about 155 hours. And the game's not even out yet. I think I've got my money's worth out of the 15 quid charged to enter the beta.
That's like a quid every 10 hours.
Yeah, that's quite good value. That. Well, I've been jetting around, upgrading things. I've managed to buy a better ship. I'm now in the Cobra Mark III rather than the shitty hauler that I was zipping about in. Basically, if someone just frowned at my ship, it would probably fall apart and explode. Whereas the Cobra Mark III, which is a model from the original Elite, it's quite a nice, reasonably hardy ship, and you can fit some decent weaponry on it. So instead of any time a pirate or anyone else tried to pull me out of faster than light travel in the system, my previous thing was to Sir Robin, which was, you know, bravely turn my tail and flee in the opposite direction to whoever's trying to do that. Now I take them on, and as a consequence, whereas before I was avoiding the combat as much as possible, now I'm starting to seek it out, and it's quite good. Trying to dogfight in space, where you've got inertia and everything like that acting on your ship, can be quite interesting. You can turn off flight assist, and that basically goes into Newtonian physics, where if you point yourself in a direction and you thrust in that direction and then turn off all the thrusters and turn around, you will continue flying in that direction until you hit something. So it can be quite handy and also a little bit disorientating.
That actually reminds me of some of the moves that they pulled in, like Battlestar Galactica and stuff.
Yeah, it's starting to it's less dogfighting in the planes,
yeah,
type sense, and more
dogfighting in space.
Yeah, where you have to think of the three dimensions much more, so you don't get yourself trapped like Khan did in his two-dimensional thinking. Star Trek reference.
Yeah,
it's been quite cool because there are all kinds of different ships, and some of them that take you on, they'll decide, right, you're doing too much damage. And bearing in mind, this is these are all NPCs' ships because I'm still playing solo. Some of them will decide, right, you're doing too much damage, it's not worth it. And some of them will dump their cargo at you. So missile locks and everything like that will, tend to, hit those instead. And then, jump out. And others will fight you to the death. And my God, there are some big ships that I've been stopped by. But some of them I've managed to take on. One of them managed to disable my ship and blow out my canopy just with about two shots.
Oh, blimey.
That was it. It's like playing it and you go, oh, yeah, my canopy's just gone. And now I'm in emergency oxygen mode after slipping on a mask. I didn't know that could happen. It's quite cool. I'm going to die now. And I did. But if you take on pirates in a system, you can gain bounty on them, which you can then fly to a nearby port, and you can collect that bounty. You can also take on contracts to hunt people down in certain systems, and they'll just say, hangs around in these systems, we need him taken care of quietly so he doesn't come back to us. We will pay you a nice hefty amount, which is like 10 times what you would normally get for a good cargo run or something like that. So there's the incentive there to go into the more combat thing, even though I've been playing it mostly just for exploration. and, you know, seeing what's out there and mapping, and mostly been making my money from mapping. But yeah, so I've been playing yet more Elite Dangerous. Also, over the weekend, I watched the PlayStation Experience show thing, which is Sony's own, well, game show. Either of you two watch that?
No.
No, we caught up with a couple of videos from the Video Game Awards, but that was it, or the Games Awards, or whatever they want to call themselves.
Yeah, I didn't bother with that because I just thought it would be, you know, far too much fluff. Whereas with the PlayStation one, there was more chance of things being announced and more footage being shown of things. And in that regard, yes, because there was more footage of No Man's Sky. And I still want that game. Oh, God, yes, I want it. So I'll probably play that far too much, like Elite. But it's a slightly different game. Mm. Also, as part of it, EA popped on stage, and while they didn't announce anything, they did say, oh, it's the PlayStation's 20th anniversary, so we're going to give you some games out of the goodness of our own hearts. Haha.
I don't believe you.
Yeah. So what's the catch? But it popped up, and we got them in the UK as well. It was Need for Speed Most Wanted on Vita. Plants vs. Zombies Garden Warfare on PS4, which I quote-unquote bought on the store, even though I don't have a PS4 yet. And on PS3, it was Mirror's Edge. And it's like, oh yeah, I remember that when you made more games that I gave a shit about. And I've been playing a little bit of Most Wanted on Vita, and it seems to be quite a capable version, even though it did pour Muse into my ears for far too long to be
I wouldn't complain about that personally, but that's because I like Muse.
I like some Muse tracks, and other ones it's just, oh, shut up whining. Yeah, that's what I've been doing, pretty much. Mostly Elite Dangerous with other stuff.
Well, I know what Paul's been up to, because I've been there for most of it.
Yeah, so first of all, let's talk about Life of Brian, because we went to see a screening of that, the first ever screening in Truro.
Well, the first ever public screening in Truro.
Is yours one of the areas that refused to show it?
Yeah, it got banned by the council.
The story of that was brilliant.
Okay, so we at the screening, it was for Macmillan, and Mark Kermode was there doing his usual thing that he likes to do at our cinema, and the cinema had managed to...
By the way, is he a local? Or?
No, he's... just like coming down here for the old
for the cinema, actually.
cinema.
Fair enough.
And to Radio Waterstones, as far as I can tell. And sometimes play gigs, because he does music as well. Mm.
Okay, I'm getting a bit confused now.
Yeah, he does lots of things. But he managed... Well, I won't say he, but I think the cinema managed to track down the original projectionist. He's now retired. But who showed the Life of Brian to the councillors that banned the film in the 70s. They're at the plaza. And so he came up on stage, and Mark was sort of asking him questions and that, and he was like, so when you were up there in the projectionist booth, you know, how were they reacting to the film? He's like, but they were most amused by the film when they were watching it, it turns out. I found it quite jolly in that. And then when they left the screening and sort of wandered back, because the main screen for the cinema is upstairs, they wandered down the stairs into the main foyer for the cinema. And they were like, oh, this is not fit for Truro. They said in front of a news crew that was already gathered there.
And then
the news crew were like, oh, can you do that again, but more angry? So all the councillors walked back up the stairs and then came pretty much screeching and hollering down the stairs saying it's, you know, utter filth and not fit for Truro sort of thing. So, the local councils, oh my God. They didn't think they'd banned the film, because Cornwall got a unitary authority it was before the last general election, and because of it our council elections are out of sync with everybody else. Anyway, we got a unitary authority, and of course that meant that they kind of took on a bunch of the laws and bylaws and crap that all the little district councils had passed. over the decades. And the ban that had been done by then Carrick Council had not been overturned. And some to and fro between the cinema, Mark Mode, the BBFC, and the council on that. And the BBFC said, well, no, they did ban the film. They've just forgotten they banned the film.
Oh, bloody hell.
And the council turned around and says, I don't think we've got the ability to ban the film.
And the BBFC were like, no, you can still ban films if you really want to.
Yes.
And with the hint of, I hope you don't do our jobs. But, I mean, obviously the BBFC aren't, as we've discussed recently, aren't fabulous at doing their jobs.
Assholes.
Anyway, but yeah, so we saw the first unbanned screening of Life of Brian in Truro. You know, it's only, what, released in, what, 1979? So
something like that, yeah.
Yeah, oh, 30 Christ.
Or 35 years? Not the counsellor, a very naughty boy!
It's just kind of an astounding story about, you know, kind of how petty and simplistic and
the thing is,
convoluted stuff.
It was a 35mm cut of the film that had been loaned to us by, I believe it's Terry Gilliam's daughter.
Well,
that's cool.
From the 70s, including 1970s TV ads. Well, not TV ads, but cinema ads.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So we got the first ad, was reasonable, and was directed at the ladies.
Which
in
one was
the audience,
first ad again?
The Lulu. Advertising some shoe brand.
Mm.
And I've just heard dancing around and the shoes changing in between jump cuts sort of thing.
Isn't she lovely? She's dancing in shoes.
Yes.
Aren't they lovely? Don't they make her look available, gents? Doesn't... Oh, yes. Lovely. Because they've all got lovely bottoms.
Something to that effect. But then what was worse was the ads directed at the men.
Oh.
Yeah, it's like the... Was it this... the one guy that... like he'd just kind of gone on a date with a girl and was like, oh, how do I do it? Oh, yes.
What was that product?
I don't know.
There was one like that, but I got confused because there was definitely an ad for, like, it wasn't a suit maker. It was like you paid weekly for suits. Like you got tailored suits.
Yes, that was him.
You didn't buy the suit outright when you originally started paying for it. You sort of paid for it in installments, which was just to me seemed like a crazy thing. And he just seemed to have a suit for every occasion and was just so worried about his appearance. It was sickening.
He's like, oh yes, all the ladies think I'm loaded, but in actual fact, I'm not.
Mm-hmm. God, shit.
And the thing is, though, is that it made me think about this whole concept of, like, people panicking about the idea of, like, metrosexual male. And it was like, well, if this kind of ad was going on at the end of the 1970s, I don't think it was a 2000s concept.
I was actually confused at the beginning, so I was like, I don't remember this from the original Life of Brian. Is this kind of a, you know, kind of... The Pythons kind of doing
we cottoned on that it was genuine ads made to Pearl and Dean.
And then there's like this random ad where this guy kind of kept on bobbing out of this barrel.
Oh, four ads. One was for a nightclub somewhere in...
Oh, yeah, some random nightclub.
I think it might have been in Northern Ireland, I'm not sure. and this one clip that was just this bloke, very... hefty, he was quite stout and sturdy bloke in a barrel that was up to kind of shoulder height, going up and down. Every time we came back up, he had a different outfit on. And then by the end of the ad, he sort of pops out of the barrel, and then this woman who's not at all really dressed kind of pops out of the barrel and looks around sheepishly, and I was like, what the fuck? So yes, yeah, and then we watched Life of Brian.
That's just random ads from the 70s that you couldn't do now. Not only could you not do now, but it doesn't translate to now. It's like, what?
Life of Brian was an interesting watch. I haven't watched it for many years, and it was funny realizing because I must have been. I was a lot younger when I last watched it, and I finally realised that obviously the Pythons were playing pretty much everybody. Didn't really get that before.
Mm. And it's they were kind of taking the piss out of just basically taking the piss. They weren't kind of taking the piss to prove a point about how bad, you know, colonialism or empires are or anything like that. It's just basically just let's take the piss. And well, they did on pretty much every single level.
I think they were basically...
It is one of my all-time favourite films.
I think they were mainly, though, just taking the piss out of having institutions.
Yeah. Actually, I'd agree with that.
And grammar.
Yes.
People who are obsessed with grammar.
Yes. And it was a very enjoyable watch. And anything played by Michael Palin's my favourite character, really. So... Michael Palin fan.
Police, watcher.
and then the same evening, we ended up watching Frozen for the first time
because we were just so sick of like hearing all the "Let It Go"
bullshit.
Yeah, and basically all the references and whatnot, and we'd know that this film was big. Everybody loved it. We hadn't seen it, and I was like, you know what? Just let's buy it and see what all the fuss is about. And yeah. It's okay. It's an interesting film, and it's one that doesn't necessarily kind of go with just the standard narrative. But there again, I kind of expect from the makers of Wreck-It Ralph and Tangled that it would do some things differently.
I would say that Wreck-It Ralph and Tangled were superior films to this. This relied far too much on becoming... I mean, I get that Disney films when they're animated, that they kind of stray into this weird musical territory.
Yeah.
But Frozen took it a step too far.
I quite enjoyed Tangled when...
Yeah, Tangled's got a nice balance.
That was a surprisingly good, you know, kids film. Had enough there for non-kids.
I was actually wondering to myself earlier on, it's like, why was it that I don't like some musicals, but I really like others? And I actually figured that out, that the kind of musicals that I do actually like, there's usually kind of counterpoints and whatnot. So despite the fact that each character is kind of singing about their own feelings and about the situations and stuff, there's usually more than one in a song at any one point. Whereas a lot of musicals that, you know, more kind of targeted towards the, you know, feminine, like, say, for example, this, there's usually just basically one person singing at a time about their feelings at that one time, and it seems very static. And
there was a couple of points where they tried to get the princesses to sing together, and they mushed them around a bit, and it didn't quite work, because it just got a bit confusing. And the thing I noticed, that was because almost every scene had a song, because obviously films have a lot of scenes, but that meant that they had fewer scenes in the film because they couldn't write a song feasibly for every scene, because that would be insane.
And can I just say that basically, because the entire thing came about because a misjudgment from the troll.
There's a little troll
head
dude.
The head troll that gave the advice of pretty much, you know, erase all memories and hide. Hide your powers.
Basically, there was this whole subtext to me of how, like, parents were accepting that they found out one of their kids is gay, right? And they're accepting of this, but they go and seek advice from somebody else who's like, well, it's okay that they're gay, but they're going to have to hide it. And then they hide it for their entire time of of their youth and all that, and grow distant from their other siblings, wondering why they don't. You know, they spend so much time obsessing over hiding, and
well, and they're you know, like utterly unremarkable, but yeah, also strangely fabulous.
Kind of, but they have, you know, they can't control these gay feelings because they're gay. You know, and like anyone, they have, you know, who's got feelings to one particular gender, they have the feelings, and oh god, it was just. I like Tangled more, I like Wreck-It Ralph more, and I certainly like Brave a hell of a lot more.
I think I quite liked Frozen, but I don't think it really stands up to the whole hype.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna question the tastes of obviously like 7-year-olds here. But kids, what were you thinking?
I'll just say most 7-year-olds have shit taste.
To be fair, though,
I bet they haven't watched Firefly.
Well, one of the annoying things about Disney films when I was a kid was the musicals anyway. I used to absolutely hate the musicals. The stories, you know, animation, the action and whatnot. Yes, very dramatic, very, you know, interesting and whatnot. But the sing-alongs, no.
I was just thinking there that we recently watched Brave, and I was underwhelmed by that. I thought it was going to be better than it. You ended up finding it. It was a little bit more clunky.
What, Brave?
Yeah, Brave.
I felt that Brave had a lot more going on it. I mean, technically, Frozen is an adaptation of The Snow Queen by Hans Christian Andersen.
I know they've fiddled things around.
But,
We're looking through the supposed deleted scenes, and in actual fact, they weren't deleted, they just weren't made. Because they were so early on in the process that, you know, it was basically alternate routes that they could have gone, including one where they actually had Elsa as a proper bad guy. And it's like, yeah, that really would not work. That would basically just make it just so bog standard and, ugh, vanilla.
I suppose it was the good thing is that the bad guys in the film weren't regular bad guys in a kid's film. So that was a positive. Still confused as to the PG rating situation that Frozen has.
Oh, yeah.
Following on from conversations of last week, and I have done a huge write-up on the Paddington versus Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is on Hex Dimension now. But, yeah, I don't understand how Frozen is a PG if The Lion King gets to be PG, or Hercules gets to be, not PG, sorry, Lion King's a U, Hercules is a U. I don't understand how Frozen's a U, PG.
I didn't know that.
It's also to do with the fact that the copy that we've got, on the case, it's got PG. On the disc, it's got U.
So we had to double check on IMDb to find out which thing was telling the truth. And apparently it is meant to be PG. Yeah.
It's like, that's...
It probably thought, it'll be universal. And it's like, what?
So as far as I can tell, in order for a film to get a U rating these days, if it's aimed at kids, is that it can't have any peril. But if they re-rate earlier Disney films, they'll get to still be U's.
How? Because most of them have peril?
Yeah. But that's all I can figure out. But I'm going to move us on to a final bit of this show, and I wanted to spend a bit of time this episode talking about Ralph Baer, who is unfortunately no longer with us. He passed away at the end of last week. And as many articles have called him, he was pretty much the father of video games. I think Game of Sutra were one of the first sites to really cover his passing. And as they said, Baer developed the very first console video game system, originally known as the Brown Box, but later licensed and sold as 1972's Magnavox Odyssey, which laid the foundation for video games as we know them today. So, you know, in your home, messing about.
Back in the days when it was, well, you didn't have video recorders and you had the 3 or 4 channels. And that was what the TV was for. There was nothing else you could put on the TV apart from live television.
And basically, Baer was responsible for creating a table tennis game that Atari would essentially later, I don't want to say rip off, but certainly,
be inspired by
in order to create Pong. But yeah, so Baer was 92 when he died. So he's a good inning. And if you consider what he essentially kickstarted, I mean, all three of us, video games were like a huge part of our sort of lives, basically, in terms of like how we spend our downtime and stuff and how we get
downtime
and get to have fun.
Make it sound as though we're like robots that, you know, so like occasionally switch off and just play computer games.
Occasionally power down.
Imagine there could be amiibos that do that someday. They'd be like, oh, I'm going to have some fun now. Play some video games.
I'm telling you, that's how Skynet starts. If there's a Terminator amiibo, then, you know, everything's going to hell.
I've just got this image of Terminator or like the T-1000 or something like that in Smash Bros. Now. And just basically just killing everybody. Not knocking them off the stage or anything, just literally killing them.
asking if they're Sarah Connor first, surely.
Mm. Have you seen this boy?
Retroid, what was the first console that made its way into your house, or console or computer of some sort?
Oh, the first console that came into my house was a Philips G7000. And everyone goes, oh yeah, the Philips G7000. We remember that well. That's a very important, must talked about console. No, it's not really. But it was a rebadged European version of the Magnavox Odyssey 2, which was the follow-up to the original Magnavox Odyssey. Now, I was trying to work something out about it, and I said, yes, the Odyssey 2 was, you could say that was the first true home console, because it had ROM cartridges with programs. The original Magnavox Odyssey that Beyer created was in some ways more clever, because what it actually was, because I kept seeing references to, you know, cards, and I thought, now, I remember that the original Atari Pong, there was some debate in that with emulation in the markets and, you know, things like that, because it wasn't a program. It was actually logic circuitry to move things around on the screen. There was no program there for it to run. It was entirely circuit logic. And that's apparently what he created. Ralph Beyer created the Magnavox Odyssey, and all the games that were available for it were differently laid out logic gates on printed circuit boards, which I think is an amazing thing, considering he was the first one to, you know, really come up with this. A box that plugged into the TV that you could alter what it did, you know, things like football or tennis, or, you know, most things that just involved static screens and dots moving. It's pretty much, you know, the what's the crappy games console that they have in Grand Theft Auto Vice City? Degenitron. You know that?
I don't know. To be honest, I've not really been... Well, I've not really played much of most of the GTA games. I mostly just, you know, steal cars, run people over, and then try to escape the police.
Well, it's mentioned on the radio where they say, you know, it's stuff like, you know, you are a, you know, big red square trying to run away from the blue squares. Or you are a green square that's trying to capture the purple squares. You know, that kind of thing. Because there was just virtually nothing else you could do with them. It was just squares on the screen of varying size, that some of which you could move and some of which were moving towards you, or were walls. And that's what the original Magnavox Odyssey was. Now, I do really like the idea, actually, of someone managing to create games using logic gates. That deeply appeals to a nerdy side to me, that, you know, that's fiddled around with electronics. But, yeah, that was released in 1972 in the US, the original Magnavox Odyssey. It sold about 350,000 by the time it got slightly rebadged in 74. Now, bearing in mind how many, you know, games consoles are sold now, you can see how, you know, how big the market is now, how things have progressed. But yeah, in the first year alone, it sold 100,000 in US homes. Now, up until then, as I said, there wasn't anything else you could do with a television apart from tuning to a TV channel. Mm. So the idea of being able to do something like this in your own home, if you could control what was on the television, that was a bit mind-blowing. Now, that led to, you know, Atari creating, you know, their own things, the original TV Pong games that Atari did as well, that, you know, there was a whole big explosion in the 70s of, you know, these, you know, TV table tennis games and that sort of thing. We got them over here as well, but it wasn't quite as focused on certain companies. We got Grandstand, for example. They had their own over here, and they did LED games and stuff like that, but it wasn't really until home computers came out about that, things really took off. But Ralph Baer is the man who created this market.
And
it's
quite amazing, really, that... I mean, I suppose one of the reasons why we should be talking about this is the fact that anyone who passes away in the literary world or the cinema at the moment, I mean, the people that founded those formats are long gone.
Mm.
Whereas, obviously, video games is still quite a recent medium, so to have somebody like Ralph Baer finally go, it's quite something, really.
It is, because we've gone from discrete logic gate circuitry. As I said, the original games were just variations on printed circuit boards. I'm not talking ROM, RAM, anything like that. They didn't have anything like that. He worked out a way to do this on the most basic level and get it into people's homes, and it was a success. And once that happened, you couldn't really turn back and say, we're not going to bother plugging in anything else into the TV. So he was a pioneer, and he's gone now.
It's just kind of crazy sort of talking about the whole logic gates setup that obviously his original games had, and then talking about, in comparison to this episode, crap that's going on with Amiibos now.
Yes.
It's like, sure, Nintendo aren't the most realistic, high-end graphics, whatever bullshit at the moment, but the Amiibos are offering an innovative form of play.
Yeah.
And it's just to think that since 1972, in that time, so 7 years before Life of Brian,
yes,
came out, we had... Whereas
Life of Brian is, it's seen as a classic film,
yeah,
not an old and obsolete
film. Mm.
That's the big difference there.
Yeah. But, you sort of... Two products in the same decade, and film's still got a lot of respect. Games, not so much, but games have perhaps made some of the most humongous technological...
Well, the thing is, though, is that games have evolved very fast.
Yes, it took... If I was going to compare novels and film to the development of games, like novels, it took more than a century for novels to reach a decent format which we would recognize today as being a proper novel and something that's quite enjoyable to read,
yeah,
in terms of format. I mean, a lot of early novels were really no more than collections of letters or fake diary entries that were used mostly to pad out a narrative. Mm. And then so the whole idea of having this sort of authorial voice, either it being the voice of a character or a third person narrator, slowly evolved,
mm,
and things like that. But that took that took best part of 100 years or more, really, for that to happen. And film, I mean, there were some interesting things happening at the turn of the last century, in the late 1800s.
Yeah,
but I wouldn't say it didn't really come. It took.
Well, I mean, there's the 20s? A lot of different influences, yeah, that kind of guided,
yeah,
cinema, both from the industry itself and the technology behind it as well.
But would you say it wasn't until the 1920s when the silent films were really,
yeah, well,
popular,
yeah,
that things had perhaps
start taking off and becoming, yeah, that much more of a moneymaker, and then you get later on, you get kind of the blockbusters. It's about 30 years later or so. And yeah, it just got so big. Faster, obviously, than novels and whatnot, but it's still slow in comparison to... I mean, put it this way, was it Mario or is it Zelda that's meant to be getting their 30-year anniversary? 30 years!
I think that sounds Mario as a character.
Yeah, that sounds like... Yeah.
a long period of time. By the same token, for a medium, that is, you know, what most of the game, most of the Nintendo games players are over 30 years old.
Sure. I wonder if the more technology there is involved in a media product, the faster it develops.
Mm.
Because poetry took, well, poetry is based on the spoken word, it's based on the oral tradition, and it's still evolving. But there's not much tech behind it beyond the printing press. Novel writing, I mean, novels due to their size, really depended on the printing press. Film, obviously, there's a lot of technology involved. Yeah, I mean,
you had the 70s with, you know, handheld cameras that kind of made, you know, films kind of come alive and whatnot in different ways. And then you had basically the, was it the vertical integration system being disbanded and whatnot, so that you had kind of a, whereas like before they had some kind of set studios that they do everything in, then they started to basically take stuff away from the studios and basically go out and do stuff out in the real world and whatnot, and then TV shows started inhabited the you know, the space that were taken up by films. So the studios then became basically more for kind of TV series and whatnot rather than, you know.
It's all in learning and building on what else is already there and what works for the new format.
The thing about video games, though, is that certainly when they're narrative-based, they combine elements that have been refined in novel writing and filmmaking. Yeah. It's taking, so they're taking like the strong narratives of novels and films, and taking the what film has learnt about sound and visuals,
and then
combining it with computer science and coding.
Yeah. I mean, films, for example, they obviously kind of took from theatre originally.
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember I've seen a fair few old films, and even the, you know, the early talkies and, you know, the musicals and such. Those were based pretty much entirely on cinema, on, well, not on cinema, on theater,
stage performances,
And then of course they started working out that the kind of things that you couldn't do on a stage. Because you had the one location and you couldn't keep the audience waiting, that suddenly didn't matter in film.
Well, once more, because film, you kind of do it once and you've got it forever. That obviously meant that you know, you didn't have to have actors that knew absolutely their lines throughout the entire thing before started filming. You can actually do it in parts as well. And there's just so many different, you know, differences and whatnot. I mean, the whole thing about the Nouvelle Vague, or the French New Wave, is that Truffaut was writing against basically this tendency in French cinema to basically just televise or film, in essence, you know, old plays.
And he was trying to made perfect sense why they were doing that, but it took someone coming along and saying, you don't have to.
Yeah, the gaming equivalent is where we get tons of tie-in games for movies, or movie games and stuff like that.
Well, games are only now, especially in RPGs, finding ways to do their own thing. The earliest games, most of the Magnavox Odyssey games that came out, were based on sport or shooting or something that was, you know, just very easily graspable. So, I mean, I'm looking down the list here, and it's baseball, basketball, cat and mouse, dogfight, football, handball, haunted house, hockey, invasion, safari, roulette, shooting gallery, all, you know, a lot of the things which...
Or simulations almost.
Yeah, they're just, you know, they're taking their rules and ideas from sports and fairground games, most of them. And it's only when they started, you know, fiddling about with, you know, something a little bit more complicated. I mean, first of all, coin-ops came, you know, about. And, of course, most of their mechanism was trying to get you to shovel in more money, another 10 pence or another quarter. So they had lives and continues, And so, you know, that influenced games and game design for a while. The, you know, the only reason that, you know, continues existed in games was because of arcade machines. They make no sense in a home game.
No.
But they are, you know, they are there because people kind of expected them. And then they started, you know, moving away from those and gaining some more of the influence from, you know, tabletop games or role-playing games. And now there's a hell of a lot of games. You can play a, you know, a first-person shooter, and it will have things that you would have considered to be RPG mechanics.
Yeah.
Years ago.
Being able to upgrade weapons and stuff.
Yeah, so suddenly people are, you know, it's all this cross-pollination and things have accelerated a lot.
Absolutely. I mean, part of the problem is, though, is that you very rarely find games that manage to basically incorporate all these different elements like racing and shooting and beat-em-ups and platforming and stuff like that, and actually manage to do them all well.
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure about platforming, but I would say, you know, the GTA type sandbox is the, you know, it's come closest to, you know, that kind of dream, if you could call it that. But yeah, it's even a little bit more complicated.
Yeah, even still, none of the stuff actually seems as refined as it should be with a dedicated game. So say, for example, you have bowling in GTA 4. That's nothing like bowling in real life, or even any bowling simulators like Wii Bowling, or, you know, I don't know, any of the PC ones that you can get.
True, but on the other hand, I was playing bowling games on my Commodore 64 and friend Spectrums, and bowling in GTA 4 is a hell of a lot better than those. it's all progressive, but I think looking at it, as you know, Emily said, with Life of Brian and the Magnavox Odyssey being released, you know, in the same decade, just a few years apart, really, I mean, the years between them, I think it's, you know, it's been less than the time the 360 and PS3 and the Wii have been out.
Yeah, it was less.
Yeah. So that's a bit mad, thinking that, you know, we've gone from those releases to we're now in the next, you know, well into the next generation with the sales of those. And looking at the progressive complication that's gone into, you know, complication, innovation, iteration with games, you can see why sometimes now, well, actually, unfortunately, often, you get people who don't play games and, you know, they're older than any of us. And they'll just have this weird concept of games. And you think, where on earth have they got that? And it's just, well, they, you know, they probably saw TV Pong at some time in the, you know, the 70s or, you know, very early 80s. And that's what TV games are. That's what computer games are to them. And they've just not bothered. So their loss.
Yeah.
But I find it understandable, just disappointing.
Well, I'm afraid, chaps, that that really is all we've got time for this week. And I just want to say again, like, it is sad that the father of video games has passed, but I feel incredibly thankful for what he helped to enable.
Absolutely.
He did incredible things with virtually sod all.
I mean, it's amazing how, you know, all these things that we take for granted, like the internet and how you're listening to us and everything, was basically because one person was there and did something special.
Showed there was a market for people to do these things on their TVs.
Yeah. So it is goodbye from...
It's goodnight from me, Paul Wood. I'm Retroid on Eurogamer.net and Super Retroid on Twitter.
It's goodnight from me, Paul Blewett, and I'm on Twitter as at Paul Blewett.
It's goodnight from me, Emily King. I'm on Twitter at EK6891. Geekyknittingexperiments.tumblr.com is the place to go if you're looking for some geeky knitting inspiration at the moment. If you know some, if you want an individualistic Christmas gift and you're looking for either inspiration for yourself or something you can bug somebody to make for you, I've definitely found some good stuff at the moment, so do have a peek. You can find Nerd Assemble over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. We're also available on iTunes and Stitcher. tweet. You can tweet us at Nerds Podcast Plus. You can find us on Facebook and Google Plus as Nerds Assemble Podcast. Don't forget to check out HexDimension.com, which includes the write-up of Paddington v. Raiders of the Lost Ark and an exploration of, you know, PG versus U film ratings. Well,
they're not really versus each other.
No, they're just battling it out a bit.
They're just going, what the hell's going on with the BBFC?
Everyone's wondering what's going on with the BBFC.
I've been wondering that since the 80s.
Yeah.
Mutter, mutter.
But good night.
Good night.
Good night.